Parenting doesn't come with a manual, and when your child learns differently, there's no one size fits all. Here, we think out the box. We celebrate every unique mind, every different path, and every win, big or small. Welcome to Out the Box, where kids and parents grow together.
Good morning and welcome to Out the Box on 101.9 Chai FM. For minds that don't fit the mold and hearts that keep striving. I'm Simone, mom, teacher, and literacy and dyslexia therapist. Last time, we spoke about vocabulary and text management, how children can read the words but still don't fully understand them. If you missed it, you could catch it on the Chai FM website under Simone Herring Podcasts. Today is part two, and we're focusing on something practical, how to teach comprehension strategies step by step. Because comprehension doesn't just happen, it must be taught, modeled, and built. Send your thoughts or questions to simon@chai.co.za or WhatsApp 061 895 1019. Joining me today, and I'm always grateful for her insight, is Dr. Tali Frankel. Tali is not only highly respected in the field of speech and language development, literacy, dyslexia, and other specific learning disorders, but she's also a special friend of Chai FM. She brings both warmth and depth to every conversation about learning and children. Tali, it's always a privilege to have you on the show.
It's always a privilege to be asked back.
So in our first episode, which was 2 weeks ago, and I encourage all the listeners to go and download that podcast and listen to it because this is part two. In that episode, we spoke about vocabulary and text management. And we unpacked the importance of teaching vocabulary and comprehension explicitly. So as a quick catch-up, why is vocabulary so vital for comprehension? And what does explicit teaching mean?
Okay, so just as you said, quick revision. So when we think about vocabulary, we think about the fact that vocabulary carries the meaning of language. It's the words that carry our understanding of concepts, labels of objects, actions. And as kids get older, the vocabulary that they need to integrate becomes more abstract and conceptual. And so often when children have difficulty learning language, they often have a deficit in terms of the quality of vocabulary that they learn, as well as the quantity of words that they learn. And those kids need special instruction. Those kids are the kids who are not going to pick up those words just vicariously through listening to adult conversation or peer-led conversations. Those kids are often the kids who don't enjoy reading, and so they don't have access to that rich exposure that reading can bring and being able to create meaning from what you read. And so we spoke about a whole bunch of different ways to encourage vocabulary in our kids, especially in our older kids, and the need to teach not just word meanings but word connections in terms of what other words are similar, what other words are dissimilar, what is the root of the word, how can we add to the word or change it, what part of speech is the word, can we change it into different parts of speech so that we develop depth as well as number of words.
Right. And I remember you saying last time on the show that, and you said that it was quite a contentious comment, but you said that you can't just give a child a book to read or a child who struggles with comprehension, and that it needs to be guided because otherwise they're just reading and not actually understanding what they're reading.
Right.
So moving on, we spoke about the key strategies which we use in therapy, and they were comprehension monitoring, which we discussed on the last show, graphic organizers, question answering, question generation, and story structure. So let's move into graphic and semantic organizers.
Right.
Can you tell us about this key strategy and explain how the strategy works and helps children to understand?
Okay. So it's not novel to discuss the idea that different people learn in different ways. Some kids are auditory learners and they hold on to information that they hear. Many children are not. And so a visual representation that engages their ability to look at something or see a picture of something is often very helpful. So these graphic and semantic organizers are visual representations of knowledge. So it could be a diagram, or it could be a picture, or it could be a mind map that helps them to structure information and show the relationships between the individual units of information. And you can use, there are a whole bunch of different types of graphic and semantic organizers, which we can talk about, but often children who need a visual anchor and engage their visual sense. And we talk a lot about multisensory learning, bringing in lots of different senses. So not just looking and not just hearing, but actually being able to look and make a picture, and associations with pictures can often be very helpful.
So how would you lead that if a child was reading a text and you spoke about the different types of graphics? So for example, Venn diagrams or storyboard, chain of events, story maps, cause and effect. In therapy, how would you guide a child to use their graphic strategies?
Okay, so I think it's important maybe to go through each one separately so that we can explain to our listeners what those different strategies look like, and then give a couple of examples of how you might apply those strategies.
Okay.
So if we take a look at a Venn diagram, I'm not sure if everyone knows what a Venn diagram is, but essentially if you can imagine a Venn diagram as two circles next to one another that then overlap in the middle. So you've got a circle with a part of that circle on its own on the left, an overlapping section where the second circle starts to join, and then you've got the second circle with its own space on the right. And what's really good about Venn diagrams is that they're helpful in terms of helping kids to compare and contrast information from two different sources. So this can be applied to lots of different subjects. You can imagine, for example, in a life science subject where you're comparing different classes of animals, for example, or different kinds of organisms. So the things that would be similar in the middle is that you would need a system for respiration because all living organisms need to breathe. Right. You would need a reproduction system because all living organisms reproduce.
Right.
But then there would be very distinct differences depending on, for example, the where that organism lives and what environment they have to adapt to. So, you know, an amphibian would be very different to a mammal, for example. So you would have the things that are similar in that little in-between crossover space, but you would have their differences on different sides of the circle.
So very useful when children are asked to contrast or differentiate or evaluate the different types of areas that an organism exists or the similarities.
Exactly. You could even think about it in terms of history, for example. Like if you were comparing different revolutions, like the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution, what were the key factors that are similar to all revolutions? But what was unique to the French Revolution? What was unique to the Russian Revolution?
And I think that's particularly useful in history because on timelines, we only give the timeline for the Cold War, but we don't always give what's happening elsewhere in the world.
Right.
And children are often asked to compare what was happening in this country and in that country during the Cold War. And I think that is something that's really important, that they can see that.
Right.
So moving on to storyboards and the chain of events.
So again, this is also very useful for things like history, where you do need to understand a series of events in a particular order, and that's where a timeline could potentially be useful. So storyboards are literally that. It's a timeline where you start on the left, and then you draw a line, and you finish on the right, and you mark the different periods on that line with significant events or significant processes. So you can actually see how a process begins, how it unfolds, and then how it concludes. Or how a story in terms of history, like what were the factors that set up the world, you know, the factors that started World War II, how World War II started, and then how it finished.
Amazing. I think that's so useful. We're talking about graphic strategies that can help our children answer comprehension questions properly.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We're back on Chai FM 101.9 on Out the Box, and we're talking about text management with Dr. Tali Frankel. If you have any questions or thoughts, please send them to simon@chai.co.za or on the WhatsApp line 061-895-1019. So let's move on to now story maps and cause and effect.
Okay, so story maps are great. I actually use story maps quite a lot, and I find that they are useful in terms of, number one, helping children to understand and comprehend the structure of a story, but it's also quite useful when they actually have to do their own written work, because it provides them with a structure from which to work so that their work is a little bit more coherent, a little bit more organized, better sequenced. So what you do in a story map is you actually imagine, see, this is where I wish we could have a visual assistance.
Yes.
So if you can imagine almost like a big rectangle at the top of your page with a heading. So let's say we're going to try and understand the comprehension that we're reading. Let's say it's about Coco the gorilla who was in the Stanford laboratory lab and she learned how to use sign language. Okay, so our heading is going to be Coco the gorilla. Then what we can do underneath that is we can put like a little arrow and we can put more boxes. And in those boxes, we can identify the main characters. And this can be true of plays. It can be used with set works, can be used again with history. Who are the protagonists? Who are the main characters of this event? So in this particular case, in the story of Coco, the main characters would be Coco the gorilla herself and her trainer, Dr. Penny Patterson, who was the researcher who taught Coco how to do sign language.
Right.
Once we've identified our main characters or protagonists, we then want another line where we talk about the context or the setting. Where does it happen? When does it happen? So what country, what timeline? And that gives us a sense of the context or the environment within which this particular story took place. And then what we're going to do is we're going to set out the events that take place, so the initiating events. So what actually starts off this story? And what starts off the story is the question that Dr. Patterson had about whether or not humans were the only species that could actually generate creative language. And so it was her research question to find out whether primates, who are from an evolutionary perspective, if you're looking at the scientific context, the academic context, right, who are the most similar to humans, could they also then generate abstract language themselves? And so from that question then arose her visitation of Coco at the zoo, teaching Coco sign language from when she was one, Coco learning some of the signs and then being so good at it that she was then removed and brought into the Gorilla Foundation at Stanford University. So then you have the initiating event and the subsequent events that unfold as a result of that. And then you would have some sort of a conclusion. So what happened at the end of all of it? So in this particular case, the end of it was that there was a lot of controversy around the fact that this research had been done in the first place. And in retrospect, when other researchers asked Dr. Patterson if they could also duplicate her results, she had an ethical hesitation around it, that in hindsight, she felt that maybe keeping gorillas in such unnatural conditions was not necessarily in their best interests. And so you've got the conclusion with some of the questions that it leaves you with. But that ability to break up a story into who is it about? Where does it happen? What's the initiating event? What kinds of conflicts arise? What are the solutions to those conflicts? How do we conclude? What lessons do we learn? Is often a very useful structure for both understanding text by filling in those different pieces of information and in terms of generating text, right, to make sure that you've got a coherent sequence.
And it reminds me of when we start at a very young age and we ask children who, what, where, how, and why.
Yes.
This is a deeper, obviously, because the children are older, this is a deeper way of attacking a text.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's go on to what I've heard about, you know, from school and from my son, the QAR and self-questioning.
Yes.
Why is spontaneous self-questioning important? And how would a therapist model self-questioning for a child?
Okay, so this QAR strategy has a lot of different manifestations. And you can find it, so different schools, different pedagogic institutions will adopt the system that they feel is best. So for example, like if we have kids at King David, for example, we are very familiar with that SQA, SQLA technique. And essentially what it's doing is it's teaching students to categorize questions into the questions that can be answered by referring back to the text. So in other words, just literal questions. It's really just a matter of finding the information and locating it and being able to reflect literal information that they've understood. So there's the literal questions. It also helps them to categorize those questions that require more higher order thinking. So where they've got to show that they've understood information that is not explicitly stated. Mm. It is only hinted at or it is only mentioned indirectly through a particular choice of word. And in high school, they talk about diction a lot. How does the choice of word that's being used in a text give you insight into an author's attitude towards something, a character's feelings about something, right. Their reactions to something? And so what you need to do is you need to teach kids how to gather the information or the evidence from several different sentences or sources in order to be able to answer those questions. And also sometimes they need to generate their own opinions, which means that they've got to use those working memory skills to reach back into their own previous background knowledge about something to be able to then formulate what they think about something. And kids with reading difficulties often find that quite challenging.
Right, that inferencing, that higher order thinking, you know, the executive thinking, you know, the kids that do have specific learning difficulties really do struggle with that area. Let's move on to the SQLA, which you spoke about, which is regularly used at King David. I'm not sure which other schools use it, but I do know that it's an important skill that is taught at King David. Can you briefly explain it?
Sure.
And then help us by giving us strategies to help our children differentiate between answers that are found in the text and those that do require deeper thinking.
Okay. So just, I think it's helpful, as you said, to just talk about what the SQLA technique is and how it's applied at school level. And often when the kids are introduced to these comprehension techniques, they are told that they are going to be like detectives, finding evidence in the text that will allow them to answer the questions and satisfy the requirements of each individual comprehension questions. So just to break it up, the S stands for search and select, the Q stands for quote, the L stands for link, and the A stands for analyze. So even if we look at it at quite a basic level, let's say your child is reading a chapter from The Magic Finger by Roald Dahl. And we know that this is a story about this girl who lives next to the Greggs, and the Greggs love hunting, and she despises hunting, and she tries to get them to stop, and they won't. And one day they come out of the forest with this beautiful baby deer, and she loses her temper completely, points the magic finger at them, and turns them into wild geese. Or wild ducks. I can't remember what it was exactly, right? And at the end of that chapter, she says something like, I did something I never meant to do, and I pointed the magic finger at them. Now, a teacher could ask something like, did the girl in the story mean to point the magic finger at the Greggs? Mm. So now, if your child has to answer that question, the first thing that they need to do is go back to the text and search. So that's the first almost tool that you have to teach your kids. Where would you look for that information? Mm-hmm. Is it likely that you would find it at the beginning of the text, in the middle of the text, at the end of the text? You have to teach kids not to go back to the beginning every single time they need an answer for something and reread the entire text in its entirety. It is exhausting, it is labor intensive, and it's a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
So part of that very first problem solving is getting them to work out, where am I likely to find the answer, and go directly to that place.
Right.
Okay, so this would have happened at the end of the story. So you would direct them to look at the last few paragraphs of the story. Then they want to select the words that provide the evidence for the answer, which in this case is, I did something I never meant to do.
Mm.
That is the evidence that it was unintentional.
Mm.
She hadn't planned it. And so once they've selected that, they can now quote specifically, they can lift those words straight from the text with a quotation mark and put that on their piece of paper, because now they are providing the evidence for how they got to their response.
Right.
So this quote, "I did something I never meant to do," and now you use your linking word, shows that or proves that or yes. suggests that, and my analysis of the question. She never meant to, or that it was not intentional to point the magic finger at the Greggs. So that would be quite a very basic example of how you would use it. Obviously, in high school texts, this is far more complex, where children are being asked to look at how the diction informs them of a writer's attitude towards something or a writer's tone. And there they're looking for words that convey those ideas. What do we know that the writer thinks about this based on the words that they used? And then we can quote those words and show why we think that that means that the writer is supportive of something or critical of something.
Tully, that just like draws me back to, you know, you and our passion about the kids with learning disorders and difficulties. Extra time in an exam would be so essential for a child who struggles with comprehension, especially even with the strategy, because they need to go back and continue referring and then inferencing and answering what the question is actually asking. So I implore parents who have children with specific learning disorders, please ask the school, apply for extra time. If your child has a difficulty, they will get extra time. Okay, so going on further, where we now get to SQLA and question generation request in inverted commas.
Mm-hmm.
We've discussed how many schools use the SQLA strategy. Now we move on to a different type of strategy. So I'd like you just to unpack for us what question generation, otherwise known as request, is and how it works.
Right. So, you know, it's so interesting because when I learned about this later on from an academic perspective as a comprehension technique, it made me think of my dad who taught me IT. And he actually made us do this a million years ago when I was in matric in 1994, when we studied IT. And he made us go through our notes every day. And our homework was always to generate questions about the material that he had taught us. And he always maintained that that was an excellent way of making sure that we understood the work that we had learned. But we can go into the steps in a minute.
What a blessing that you had a father who knew exactly how to do that. And it becomes innate, I would imagine, if he continues asking you these types of questions. And that's important because I think that our parents can help children out there who are struggling a lot by doing these kind of things that your dad did. Not all comprehension questions are the same. Your children may struggle not because they don't know the answer, but because they don't understand what type of question is being asked.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
You're listening to Out the Box on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Simon, and together with Dr. Tully Frankel, we're unpacking practical strategies to help your child understand how to approach and think through a question. Tully, you were telling us the story about your dad asking you questions that fit into this question generation request that we were talking about.
Right.
Let's just go back into that.
Okay. So the homework that my dad used to give us as an IT teacher was that he made us reread our notes at home, and then in the margins of our notes, we had to generate our own questions about the material. So that's really what request is about. I think that sometimes some of these comprehension techniques are I'm not going to say avoid it, but maybe they're not always universally employed because they can be time-consuming. And you can't just show a child how to do it once and then expect that they have it. These are the kinds of things that require scaffolding and time and patience. However, the investment is so well worth it. Mm-hmm. It's this initial big investment of time and attention and practice, which then encourages and fosters increased independence in our learners. So in the first step of request, what's happening is that you do a silent reading. So both the learner and the therapist or the teacher read a common segment of the text. And when you're first introducing this technique, the segment of text that you read can be very short. It could even just be one or two sentences. And then eventually, as the student's skill set grows, you can increase the amount that they're reading in one go, so into like a whole paragraph or maybe into two paragraphs. Once you've completed that silent reading, so now you've had an opportunity to explore the text on your own independently, the next thing that happens is that the student, you have student questioning. So that's where your learner asks the teacher or the therapist as many questions as possible based on that text. And the teacher or the therapist models the appropriate responses. So you allow the student to start experimenting. And there's no prescription about how sophisticated the questions have to be. You just want the learner to start being able to generate questions. And I often do this with kids, even in grade two, where we start learning about WH words and we've read literally like a four-line story. And I'll often get them, instead of answering my questions, I get them to generate their own, just to play around with how do we understand and interpret the information that we've got.
And can I just add in that when we spoke about vocabulary, this is also, or am I incorrect in saying that this is also a good stage for children to clarify what words mean?
Absolutely, 100%. Because in formulating your own questions, you have to have some understanding of the material that you're asking about. Because if you don't, your questions won't be relevant or appropriate.
Right.
And so that gives the teacher or the therapist the opportunity to clarify, to explain, to put things into context.
Okay.
Then your third step is, step number one, you read silently together. Step number two, the student has the opportunity to ask their teacher questions. Mm. In step number three, you switch roles, and now the teacher does the questioning, and the teacher then models different types of questioning behavior, looking at a range of different questions, from your literal what and when and where to your more inferential, like why and how.
Mm.
Okay. Once you've done all of that, okay, once you've exhausted all of the questions from the teacher side and from the learner side, you're now going to repeat the procedure, but now you're going to use new segments of text. So let's say you've just read the first paragraph of a story and you've gone through that whole process. Now you're going to move on to the next segment, okay, so new segments of text, and you're going to then integrate new segments with old segments.
So let me just interrupt you there just so that I can clarify in my own mind. The child gets a text, and it's divided into those paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
Is it useful to read the entire text? Say you were in an exam. Would it be useful to read the entire text or the first paragraph and then implement the request steps until you reach the point where you're repeating the process and then going further? How should a child actually plan the reading of the text?
So it's a great question, Sim, because actually I wouldn't recommend this for an exam setting.
Mm.
Because you can see that this is actually a collaborative comprehension technique.
Of course.
And it involves going forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards, lots of repetition. It's very time consuming. So this is something that I would use when teaching a child how to examine questions and become more familiar with question types and what certain questions demand of you. So I wouldn't actually use this in an exam setting. We can talk about other things that you might do in an exam setting.
Right.
But for now, this is something that I would do when there's no pressure, when there's no time constraint.
Yes.
So it would be most effective as a classroom activity for an entire class to practice together, or in a one-on-one therapeutic situation where a teacher is working individually with a child or a therapist is working individually with a child, and you've got the time and space to scaffold this whole procedure.
Correct. I understand.
So now what you're going to do, so we've gone, just to clarify, so you have your text. You both read a part of the text. So let's say the first paragraph silently.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens is that the student asks the teacher lots and lots and lots of different kinds of questions, and the teacher models appropriate responses to those questions. Then you switch roles, And now the teacher or the therapist models different questions for the student and encourages the student to answer the different questions. So in this process, the teacher or therapist is modeling both responses to questions as well as how to ask the questions. Then what you're going to do is you're going to continue reading. So now you introduce the next segment. So now you're going to move on to paragraph two. But what you're going to do at the end of paragraph two is you encourage your student to now, when they're asking questions, to incorporate the first part as well as the second part. This doesn't mean that they have to do an exact duplication of every single question that they've already asked in the first round. But now that they've got a slightly bigger context to draw from, look at how that changes the kinds of questions they ask you and the different kinds of questions that you can ask them.
So you're basically linking back to what you've, making the link between the first paragraph and the second.
And this is also like, you know, we spoke a little bit about, we touched on cause and effect relationships. So this is also a really good way of showing learners how something that happens initially can have an impact on something that happens later.
Right.
Once you've done enough of that, the next step is then to incorporate predictions. So when you've had enough of those exchanges, so let's say you've had three rounds of this, reading, the learner asks you, you answer the questions, you ask the learner answers the questions, you repeat. So let's say you've had three sets of that. Now it's important to ask the learner to predict what they think could happen next. How will this piece end? What will the last piece of the story be? What kinds of information do they anticipate could be included at the end? And this doesn't have to be specific. It should be something that is general, that is then sort of, it's understood by the other previous pieces of information that they've already read. And then the last piece is where together the reader and the learner read to the end of the text in terms of verifying the predictions that they have made together.
And this can go back to the very beginning. It's reminding me of what we do in Rave O with the children, and we speak about the detective Sam Sleuth.
Yes.
And that's exactly what he is doing. So as you're reading the story, you keep going back and asking what questions would Sam Sleuth ask. And it's a process. So you're reading the first, then the second, and linking back and continuing doing that. When do you read the entire story again, or don't you?
You don't in this particular instance.
I want to now move on to, I mean, I read in the research that shows that this is one of the most powerful strategies in getting children to ask questions about a text that they've read. And then I read about how you link request, which is question generation, to SQLA and how they are different.
Okay, so you can see that the request strategy is a very collaborative strategy. It's literally the learner and whoever is scaffolding that or mediating that experience for them, the adult, teacher, therapist, whatever, it's very collaborative. You work on generating meaning together. And through every step, the learner is held by the orientation of their therapist or teacher, because that person is constantly either modeling how to answer questions or is constantly modeling how to ask questions. And when it comes to the predictive part, which is at the end, that's also scaffolded, because then through skill, the therapist can ask other questions about, well, you know, what do you think can happen next? And if the response isn't really an adequate response or a deep enough response, it can be, you know, do you remember when we talked about this and this? What was important about that conversation that we had? Do you think that that is going to still be important at the end? Or was this a very important thing that we discussed? Or was it something that was just a side detail? And to help learners to sort of categorize what information is central to the idea of the text and what is more peripheral. When you get to the SQLA, in the very first stages of teaching, that is also a very scaffolded or mediated process, because obviously teachers and therapists have to teach kids how to approach different questions. And often what will happen at school is that there are a range of different ways that you can apply SQLA, depending on what question is being asked or how the question is being asked. And each type of question is practiced and scaffolded. But ultimately, that becomes an independent skill, or what you want to be an independent skill. You want kids to be able to read a question and recognize which one of the SQLA questions is being asked. Is this a question where I've got to link sources together? Is this a question where I've got to comment on somebody's attitude? Is this a question where I've got to talk about the register that's being used, whether it's a formal or informal register? And each of those things would have been taught explicitly within the classroom. But ultimately, we want kids to be able to recognize those questions independently and know how to respond independently.
So it's almost like training the child to be automatic on those responses and those questions, which brings me to the question, when do we start teaching these skills and strategies explicitly? I mean, I would imagine that it needs to be done before high school.
Absolutely.
And there is that gap that exists. It's a chasm, that between primary school and high school, there seems to be no link of this kind of strategy. So how would you suggest teachers and schools and therapists can bridge this gap between, the SQLA and other strategies of teaching comprehension?
Right. It's such a great question. And I do think that there are schools that do teach comprehension strategies in a very explicit way. I also think that the school day is very busy and very pressurized, and there's a lot to get through.
Yeah.
And so sometimes there isn't always that opportunity to really teach this in the depth and with the amount of time that it deserves. So I think we'll talk a little bit about how to approach texts in general, and then explicit or specific ideas or examples of how you could do it in a classroom setting.
So we're going to do that, and I want parents just to think about how we help our children get the answer right. And is it about showing how you got there, like you would in maths, be marked on the process of how you got there? Or is it just giving the answer?
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Are your child's answers short, or do they show evidence? I'm Simone, and you're listening to Out the Box on 101.9 Chai FM. We are unpacking comprehension and text management with Tali Frankel. Please send your thoughts and suggestions and questions to simon@chai.co.za or WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. Tali, moving back into what you were talking about, the integration of the way we answer comprehensions between the two different stages of school, primary and high school.
Right. So I agree with you wholeheartedly that I think that comprehension strategies can be introduced from the moment that children have to do comprehensions, which is in grade one, grade two, right from the beginning. And I think that if learners have a basic framework, they can always build on that framework, and that framework can become more sophisticated over time. Mm. But if they have a basic framework in terms of knowing this question is something that is straight from the text, I can go back and I can look, it's a literal piece of information, as opposed to this is something that I've got to do problem solving about, but the information is there, so I can think and search. I've been given a clue about where the information is. I just need to, the question is based on facts, but I can still find it. Or there are questions where the author is encouraging you, or the tester is encouraging you to start thinking about your own ideas or to proffer your own opinion about something. And that's something that you can teach from when kids are very, very young. So you can show them the difference between a question whose answer is right there and a question where you've got to think and search. So a why question, for example, or a question about incorporating your own experiences, how do you feel when, and then your own opinions, what would you do, or what would you imagine could have been done differently.
Right.
And those things can be scaffolded right from the beginning. One of the other things that I think is useful, and you asked this when you talked about kids in exam settings, and it's one of the things that I often teach kids from grade 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all the way up, is that when they're confronted with a piece of text, It's really useful to engage in those kind of metacognitive processes. Let me look at this text and identify what it is. Is it a poem? Is it a set of directions? Is it a story? Is it a comprehension? Is it an editorial? Is it a summary? What is it? What do I know about those different kinds of texts and the expectations that are going to be associated with that text? If you are doing questions on a comprehension, it's a little bit different to when you're doing questions on unseen poetry. If you are being asked to engage in a language activity, that's different to when you have to do a summary for a teacher. And so it's useful to identify the type of text that it is. It's also useful to look at the topic or the heading, because the title often gives you clues that you can then use to generate a list of ideas about what might be coming.
A list of questions, exactly. Yeah. That generation of questions just from the title.
When I was studying at university, I remember I don't remember a lot of what our psychology lecturers taught us, but I do remember that one of the lecturers spoke about the fact that when you're introduced to a new concept, it's almost like opening up a cupboard, an empty cupboard, and there's nothing in that cupboard except the rail.
Yes.
But when you're introduced to that concept, you have a hanger. The hanger then goes into the cupboard. Now, the next time that you are exposed to that concept, when you open the cupboard, there's a rail and there's a hanger. And now you can add another hanger, or you can add an item of clothing. And so every time that you come back to that concept, or every time you have exposure to an idea, you add layers and layers of sophistication to your understanding, until eventually your cupboard is full and it's got lots of tools in it and lots of opportunities and lots of options.
I love that. And I think that we can do that from a young age, actually, physically. It's such a great idea that we can, as you said, multisensory, do that in a multisensory way. And I think the children would absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to move on to final integration that takes place within a comprehension setting. When we combine comprehension monitoring, which perhaps you can just briefly catch us up with in order to answer the question, and again, I implore parents to go and listen to the previous podcast. Tully, when we combine comprehension monitoring, graphic and semantic organizers, which are the diagrams and charts, QAR, SQLA, and question generation, what changes in the child's reading and ability to then answer questions?
Okay, so just to answer your first question first, we spoke last time about how imperative it is that kids learn how to monitor their own understanding of what they read. Good readers do that naturally. They automatically stop when they don't understand something or when something doesn't make sense. As adults, we do that when we read. You know, like if you're reading something or if you're exhausted, and I'm sure this happens to everybody, you're reading and you realize you got to the end of the page and you actually don't have a clue what you just read.
It happens to me all the time.
And then you land up rereading the same page over and over, because every time you open your book, you read the same page and you fall asleep, and then you don't remember what you read and then you start again. But as good readers, we do that automatically. We stop when we don't understand. We go back and we clarify that knowledge for ourselves in whatever way is available for us, either by using the context to give us a clue, or by actually looking something up, or by Googling something that we haven't had experience with before. Children who have difficulty with reading often don't even know what they don't understand or when they don't understand. And so we spoke about how you help kids to stop, to chunk information, to read small bits at a time, to summarize what they've learned, and then be able to identify what do they understand and what don't they, because they can't move on unless they do, and often they move on without even realizing that they haven't understood.
Right.
So that was the first part of what we spoke about. All of these techniques are tools in your toolbox as a teacher and as a therapist. You don't have to use all of them all the time. What it does is when you experiment with these techniques, you very quickly find what works best for the child you are working with. Some kids do really well with visual organizers, and some kids don't, because visual spatial stimuli can be confusing and disorganizing for them in and of themselves. Some kids are more kinetic learners, and so maybe they do use the visual stuff, but they need to move around while they do that. So maybe those are the kids who need whiteboard markers and draw all over the windows. You know, like that's how my son who studied law studied.
Yes.
You know, there was constantly law stuff all over his windows.
Yes.
Because he needed to visualize it, but he also needed to move around and walk while he was studying. So what these different techniques do is, and I wouldn't encourage you to try and use all of them simultaneously, but try one. See how the child responds. You'll get a feel for if it's something that is worth persevering or whether it's something that is completely, you know, inappropriate to the child you're working with. If you feel like there's potential, persevere a little bit. See how you can refine the technique for them. Nothing is set in stone. You can always tweak or leave out a step or add a step if it's going to make reading, understanding, comprehension better for the child you're working with. And then once you've had a chance to experiment with a few different techniques, you've got the thing that works best for that kid. And slowly what you want to do is then withdraw your support and hand over the reins to their child to foster independence.
That's really smart advice, and I won't panic the next time I have to scribe.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
So Tully, we've been talking about combining the different kinds of strategies that you can use when attacking, and I like to use the word attack because you do kind of pull it apart, attacking a text. Once we see that our children have taken to a particular strategy and we've made them more independent, when they are in that exam setting, they need to apply that strategy, correct?
Absolutely.
So my question is, do you encourage them to draw the diagram or to draw the timeline?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know that, like, kids often panic, especially those kids who need the extra time. They often panic that they don't have time to employ those strategies. But I always reassure kids that if they can use those strategies, if they use those extra 5, even 10 minutes, to be able to genuinely understand what they're reading, it makes answering the questions so much more efficient. Then they're not searching and looking and going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, because actually they've created a template for themselves that gives them the main ideas and which shows them where to look for information. And it's actually a time saver in the long run.
Yeah, completely. I understand that all too well. I mean, my son, bless him, he has extra time, 15 minutes on every hour. I don't even think we use the full exam time, never mind. And that's really true when we speak about children with ADHD or learning difficulties. They just want to get through that exam. They just want to end and then escape from that whole situation. And it is quite difficult to slow them down, to prompt them, to encourage them to use those strategies within the exam, because all they're thinking about is the rugby match that they're going to be playing later on in the afternoon.
Right.
So to the parent who has a child with a specific learning disorder or who sees that their child is struggling with comprehension and text management, what would you recommend a parent's next step should be?
So my advice is always, don't walk the journey alone. It is such a disheartening, unmotivating, anxiety-provoking journey to watch your child struggle. And even if your child isn't struggling, even if your child just has subtle difficulties that could be, maybe tweaked a little bit, or that could use a bit of support, don't walk that journey alone. Teachers are often happy to help and to spend extra time. And if the difficulty is significant enough to warrant more intensive or professional intervention, then choose somebody you can talk to who can equip you as well as your child and give you the tools that you need to support and where to step in as mom and where to, like, back off and just be the person who supports the therapeutic process.
I mean, I've had a great experience with teachers just really wanting to help a child who is struggling. I'm going to leave you with the quote by Catherine Snow. Reading comprehension involves the reader, the text, and the activity, all interacting together. Thank you for joining us, Tully, as our best friend on Out the Box. You always give such valuable insight and advice for us as parents to help our children. The song for today is The Logical Song from My Era by Supertramp, and I hope Mukundi is going to think it was a good choice. remember to WhatsApp us with any of your thoughts or questions and to send us an email. This is Out the Box, for minds that don't fit the mold and hearts that keep striving.